Good day, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Families USA's Medicaid Waivers Conference Call. As a reminder, this call is being recorded, and at this time, I would like to turn the conference over to Elliot Fishman, Senior Director of Health Policy at Families USA. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Nicole, for your help on today's call, and good morning, everyone. Welcome to Families USA's Medicaid Waivers Press Conference. Today, we will discuss the recent series of Medicaid eligibility restrictions that have been approved by CMS, with a focus on Stewart versus Azar, the lawsuit that is challenging CMS's approval of work requirements and other unprecedented changes to Kentucky's Medicaid program. We'll have a brief presentation, and then we'll be opening the call for most of the duration of the call for a question and answer session afterwards. And I want to note that in our presentation, with our focus on the lawsuit on Kentucky's waiver, we're also trying to emphasize a national political and legal context of state-by-state political advocacy regarding waivers that has not gotten the attention that it needs to in the national media. I'd like to introduce our presenters on today's call in their order of speaking. We'll be starting with Frederick Assassi, Executive Director of Families USA and former Health Division Director at the Bipartisan National Governors Association. That will be followed by Emily Borgard, who is Executive Director of Kentucky Voices for Health. And presenting third will be myself, Elliot Fishman, Senior Director of Health Policy here at Families USA. Before we begin, I want to note that this press call will be recorded, and it will also be available after the session on the Families USA website. Now I'll be turning it over to Frederick Assassi. Frederick, please go ahead.
Thanks very much, Elliot. Hi, it's a pleasure to be here. As Elliot mentioned, I'm the Executive Director here at Families. We are one of the oldest and most connected nonprofits focused on bringing the interests of our nation's families and healthcare consumers forward to ensure that the best health and healthcare are equally accessible to all in our nation. We've been doing this work on the state and national level for almost 40 years. We're here today to talk about the really important case that Elliot mentioned, which is challenging a Medicaid waiver championed by Governor Bevin of Kentucky. And as Elliot mentioned, right before coming to Families about a year ago, I was running all the healthcare work at the National Governors Association, working with many governors, most of whom were Republicans, and trying to work with their legislatures on expanding Medicaid or making changes in the Medicaid program. And I'd be happy to talk about those experiences as well as this lawsuit when we open up to questions. And Elliot also was running the waiver division work at CMS and approving Medicaid waivers. So there's a lot here we can pull from in responding to your questions and talking about the national dynamics. I've also been a Medicaid lawyer for over 15 years, working on Medicaid on the Senate Finance Committee, was one of the senior staff that negotiated the Medicaid expansion in the Affordable Care Act, so I can talk a lot about what was behind that waiver expansion and why it was created, and also have worked on representing states in negotiating waivers with CMS. As you know, in January of this year, CMS approved Kentucky Governor Bevin's request to waive federal Medicaid rules, which radically altered Kentucky's Medicaid program, which is called Kentucky Health. And it's important to note, Kentucky Health applies to most adults in Medicaid, both new expansion populations and non-expansion enrollees. So it's a very broad set of changes that they're making. And taken together would make it much harder for adult enrollees to keep coverage. And that's a really important point to focus on. The waiver is focused on adding work requirements as a basis for eligibility, increasing premiums, and creating coverage lockouts for failing to renew on time. These are all we view as kinds of cuts to the program. And these changes are scheduled to go into effect on a rolling basis over the next 6 months, starting in July, so just less than a month from now, and it's going to start in Campbell County, Kentucky, if this court doesn't strike down the changes. If implemented, it's anticipated that these changes would take Kentucky backwards, causing nearly 100,000 people to lose Medicaid coverage over the next 5 years, and costing the state millions in administrative costs, and also pulling millions of dollars in federal support from the state. And it's important to understand this in context because Kentucky really was seen as one of the most important examples after the Affordable Care Act was enacted of really making a difference in the lives of people and making sure that many more families had affordable coverage. For example, before the Medicaid expansion in 2014. So back in 2013, the state had one of the highest uninsured rates in the country. It was at 13.6%. By 2015, the uninsured rate had dropped by more than half to only 6%. It's an amazing accomplishment. And much of that decline was, in fact, because of the Medicaid expansion. It had helped so many low-income Kentucky families to get coverage. In September of 2016, 462,000 men and women were enrolled through the expansion. So in contrast to that real success, what Governor Bevin is doing is the exact opposite. He himself has estimated that 100,000 Kentuckians will lose coverage over the next 5 years. And because the changes are extremely bureaucratic, there's a lot of red tape they're creating. It's estimated it will cost the state more than $374 million over 2 years to actually try to implement these changes. It's critical to point out that we and many other Medicaid experts believe that the approval of Kentucky's waiver by the Trump administration is illegal. It is flat out illegal because the Medicaid statute does not provide Medicaid authority to approve changes that are proposed in the waiver. In particular, Section 1115 of the Social Security Act, which is the legal grounding for the Trump administration to approve waivers, is super clear. The language in the statute says, and this is verbatim, that the waiver, in order for it to be approved, it has to promote the objectives of the Medicaid program. So at its heart, a waiver is intended to test new strategies to deliver care and or expand services and supports. That's what it's designed to do. And clearly, this waiver is not promoting access. It's doing the opposite. It's actually making it harder. It's creating obstacles to receiving Medicaid coverage. And in fact, no prior administration has ever approved a waiver with the express purpose of making it harder for people to get Medicaid coverage. So really importantly, 1115 waiver authority does not provide authority to a secretary to say, here are changes that are going to make it harder for people to get coverage. And let me tell you a little bit about where we are in the case. So as Elliot mentioned, this Friday, June 15th, in the D.C. Federal District Court, Judge James Boasberg will hear arguments that will decide whether or not Kentucky can move forward with the waiver changes to Kentucky Health, either entirely or in part. Multiple parts of the program are issued, but the most important issues relate to the work requirements and the lockout periods that we just talked about. This will be the first court to hear arguments on the validity of CMS's approval of these kinds of changes to state Medicaid programs under 1115 waiver authority. And so the decision has obvious implications for Kentucky, but for many, many other states where work requirements have been demanded. And frankly, they really have been demanded by conservative legislatures in exchange for Medicaid expansion. This includes the three other states that have formally requested the CMS add a work requirements to their programs. That's Arkansas, Indiana, and New Hampshire. The work requirements are also expected or pending through administrative action from eight other states, Arizona, Kansas, Maine, North Carolina, Ohio, Utah, and Wisconsin. Finally, other states are considering adding work requirements to Medicaid, like Virginia, or have waivers in public comment periods, such as South Dakota. And then, of course, most recently, Michigan just enacted legislation that includes a work requirement. So these legal proceedings that are relate to the Kentucky case are just the first chapter in a process that should give all states pause in considering adding work requirements or making other radical changes to their Medicaid programs. A decision to stop Governor Bevin from moving forward in whole or in part is the right decision and one that should put the brakes on other states rushing to make it harder for low-income families to receive the health care provided for them under federal Medicaid law. So that's the brief overview. Let me turn it over to Emily Beauregard from Kentucky, who can talk more about the impact of this waiver on the families in Kentucky.
Great, thank you. Well, first, I just want to say thank you to Families USA for inviting me to be on today's call. You've heard pretty clearly why Kentucky's waiver and the work requirement in particular are harmful to the structure and integrity of the Medicaid program, but I want to talk about the real-life impact of these reforms for Kentuckians. As you've already heard, over the next 5 years, nearly 100,000 Kentuckians will lose Medicaid coverage to prove what we already know. More red tape and harsh penalties only make it harder for low-income working Kentuckians and vulnerable families to access the care they need to improve their health and well-being. Kentucky Health is little more than a labyrinth of bureaucratic reporting mechanisms and harsh penalties that will be nearly impossible for workers, caregivers, students, and in particular, individuals with complex needs to navigate. Regardless of whether you're already working or meet the criteria for an exemption, at the end of the day, you can do everything right and still fall through the cracks. There are dozens of scenarios that I could outline for you to make this point, but instead I'm going to share the story of a farm family currently enrolled in Medicaid. Bree Pearsall and her husband, Ben Abel, own and operate Root Bound Farm. As small business owners with fluctuating income, they have benefited immensely from having access to affordable health care through Medicaid expansion. It's allowed them to take the risk of being full-time farmers. They've been able to successfully grow their business and raise a family without having to worry that a catastrophic farm accident or an illness could destroy everything they've built. And as hardworking farmers and parents, some may assume the waiver won't impact them. Between managing the farm and caring for their kids, they could certainly meet the monthly 80-hour work requirement in a week's time. But they know that doesn't mean that they're protected from the pitfalls of the waiver. They've already learned that lesson the hard way. Earlier this year, after welcoming a new son into their family and trying to do the right thing by reporting a change in household size, the worker processing their change input their annual income as monthly. It was a simple but incredibly costly mistake that led them to be deemed ineligible in the system and suddenly left their family without coverage. You can imagine how scary that must have been for parents of a newborn. Regardless of the fact that this was an administrative error, correcting it wasn't easy, quick, or straightforward. It took a lot of time, phone calls, and perseverance on their part to solve a problem that someone else created. If you're wondering if this is an unusual case, let me assure you that it isn't. Something very similar happened recently to my sister and her husband, also farmers, leaving them and their three daughters without coverage for 2 months. Unfortunately, administrative errors are just already common enough, and adding layer upon layer of new bureaucratic reporting requirements to an already understaffed system is a recipe for disaster. This is one of those situations where the state seems to be building the ship as they're sailing it. Members of our coalition have attended dozens of meetings and public forums with state officials over the past few months, and there's been one consistent takeaway. We're less than 3 weeks away now from go live on July 1st, and nothing has been finalized. From one meeting to the next, policies and implementation plans change. The FAQs posted on the state's website are out of date. No regulations have been published or approved. The My Rewards program is live, but people can't access it because they either haven't heard about it or can't follow the multi-step account setup. Thousands of parents who assume they're covered under traditional Medicaid, which means that they shouldn't lose their dental, vision, or transportation benefits, are going to find out on June 15th that they were quietly moved into Medicaid expansion and won't have time to earn My Rewards points before they lose those benefits. Meanwhile, there have been no workforce readiness studies, and we have yet to see a plan for creating better-paying jobs with benefits. The irony is that Medicaid is already an effective work support. If we've learned anything from the past 4 years of Kentucky's Medicaid expansion, it's that people are able to engage in their health care, keep a job, and be better parents exactly because they're covered in the first place. We've heard story after story from Medicaid members and providers that people are taking ownership of their health, and to us, that's the skin in the game that really matters. And there's plenty of evidence to prove we've moved the needle on Kentucky's health, despite what the governor may say. The bottom line is that Governor Bevin is using Kentucky Health to solve a problem that doesn't exist, and if it's implemented, I have no doubt that people will lose coverage at no fault of their own, our health care safety net will be stretched to the brink, and the health and well-being of hundreds of thousands of Kentuckians will hang in the balance.
Thank you, Emily. This is Elliot Fishman, Senior Director of Health Policy here at Families USA. And as Frederick mentioned, I ran the Medicaid Waiver Group at CMS from 2013 until April of 2017. And based on that experience, as well as my broader career working on Medicaid and health policy, I want to emphasize how much of a historic departure these waiver approvals are. So there's a legal requirement that waivers have a Medicaid objective and are a legitimate actual experiment. And when I was at CMS, those legal requirements were a real part of the deliberation process. And that was very much true of waivers that involved conservative ideas, which were structured as true policy demonstrations. For example, the Arkansas private option waiver tested the question of access and networks between commercial versus traditional Medicaid coverage. And the Indiana HIP 2.0 waiver tested using premiums versus cost sharing and offering different benefits for premium versus free Medicaid plans. These new waivers, starting with Kentucky's, are simply ways to fundamentally change the Medicaid program without going through Congress. They have no real experimental character, and the fact that they are being proposed in so many states at the same time across the country underlines the essentially structural change that is being attempted here. The Kentucky lawsuit's one important battleground in this fight, but there's also a political fight happening in state legislatures and executive branches around the country that will potentially determine whether these policies take effect in a few states or in much of the United States. Families USA is working closely with state-level and community-level consumer advocates, and it's an intensive effort to meet this unprecedented multi-state threat. And I want to particularly call your attention to this because it's hugely consequential and it's happening without much national media attention. This battle over restrictive Medicaid waivers at the state level is in a lot of ways reminiscent of the fight over the future of Medicaid that took place in Washington, D.C. last year, and it calls on a similarly flexible and urgent response by advocates. Families USA, we've created template and model materials for advocates and strategic resources in the Waiver Resource Center that's on the Families USA website, and I certainly invite you to check that out. But beyond those published resources, we and many state-level advocates are engaged day-to-day, week-to-week, in what will be a long struggle over years to defend the gains that Medicaid has made in coverage, and also the gains that Medicaid has made in terms of the process of gaining and keeping Medicaid eligibility, gains that had, until Kentucky's waiver, dramatically simplified the process to one with minimum documentation. And I think that the story that Emily told really underlines how much documentation and paperwork barriers are going to drive at least as much people to lose Medicaid as the actual formal requirements in these waivers. So we would love to talk about both the national fight and the specific lawsuit that is beginning this week in Kentucky. My presentation concludes our three speakers for today, and now we will open it up for reporters with any questions on this topic, and our operator, Nicole, will help us facilitate.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question over the phone today, please press star and then one. You will hear a voice prompt letting you know when your line has been opened in order to ask your question. Please introduce yourself by name and outlet before asking your question. We will be taking questions from the phone first and then going to our web questions. We'll take our first question. Caller, please go ahead.
Hi, this is Todd Spangler with the Detroit Free Press. So my question is, it's a couple of questions, actually. First of all, I wanted to ask, other than the states that have had their waivers approved or the several that are pending, other than Michigan and the law in Michigan, I believe you mentioned Virginia and South Dakota as two others that are in the process of getting to those waivers. Am I right about those states? And are there any others that you know of that are in the process? That could segue into any more details about this national process or fight that you're trying to mount to stop this, other states where you're seeing this bubble up that you might be able to talk about. And the last thing I just wanted to ask quickly is, in Kentucky, it sounded as though you were saying that people had been moved quietly from regular Medicaid to Medicaid expansion. And I just was hoping you could explain that a little more. Thank you.
So this is Elliot. I'll take the first part of your question, and then Emily, I'll suggest you take the second part of that question. As to what other states are in process, so there's different steps that we were alluding to in terms of describing the number of states that are in process. Some states are currently actively formally submitted to the federal government and under consideration by the federal government. And those states are significantly further along in the process than Michigan is now. South Dakota is a state that is likely preparing for federal submission. They have a proposal that is going through a mandatory state public review and comment period. And then again, presumably something will be submitted to the federal government. Virginia and now Michigan, assuming Michigan moves forward, have passed work requirements and other elements. As you know, Michigan has a significant premium element in their legislation, too. So those have passed through their legislature, but will now go to their executive branch to specify in a waiver, and then that will go through the state transparency process and on to federal review, assuming both of those states move forward.
And this is Frederick. And just to reiterate, the states that are currently work requirements are pending through administrative action are Arizona, Kansas, Maine, North Carolina, Ohio, Utah, and Wisconsin. And just to pick Utah as an example, this is a, you know, the governor in Utah had been working, Herbert, had been working for many years, was on record wanting to expand Medicaid, and his legislature was really clear that one of the things that they needed in order to expand Medicaid was a work requirement, and it really was sort of the legislature was holding him hostage on that. So this is a very typical dynamic. You've got legislators who are hostile towards Medicaid, often don't even understand the program, saw it as a part of the Affordable Care Act and saw that as something that politically they didn't want anything to do with, and as a result, are just putting up obstacles, things like work requirements or lockout periods or increased premiums. These are all policies that, as Elliot has said, run completely counter to the purpose of the Medicaid program and sort of satisfy this false narrative of many conservatives that these benefits are being, you know, should be tied to things like having to work as opposed to helping people become productive, active members of society. And then I think you had a second part of your question, which was about the design within the state of Kentucky. Emily, did you want to take that one?
Yeah, sure. So as we have been studying the waiver and the different eligibility categories, which, you know, groups of people are going to be subject to which requirements, which benefit changes, which penalties and exemptions, we started to notice that there was a discrepancy with parents, that parents were sometimes being treated as Medicaid expansion and other times as traditional, which makes sense because, you know, parents certainly are covered by both. Only in Kentucky before 2014, before Medicaid expansion, a parent with dependent children or a caregiver with dependent children only was eligible for Medicaid at 57% of the federal poverty level or below. So a pretty low threshold already. And with Medicaid expansion, many more parents and caregivers with dependents were able to get coverage. But in the way that the waiver is written, benefit changes, so that would be the reduction of, you know, elimination of dental, vision, and non-emergency medical transportation, mm-hmm. those were included the Medicaid expansion parents. And as we were trying to get a handle on how many parents were going to be affected by those changes, we learned from the state that after Medicaid expansion, there was a deal made actually with the Obama administration to move some of the traditional Medicaid members into expansion to get the more enhanced match. I'm sure Elliot could share more details about how this came to be, but what it essentially means in Kentucky is that now parents with dependent children, even if they were covered by traditional Medicaid before 2014, if their income is over, I would say, 28% of the federal poverty level, that's an estimate, but that it's generally true, then they're in Medicaid expansion. So that's many, many parents that are very low income and, you know, very vulnerable, probably have significant transportation barriers as it is, will not be able to afford dental or vision in any other way. And they unknowingly are losing these benefits. The message from the state has been, if you had coverage before Medicaid expansion, nothing changes for you in terms of your benefits. But that's not the case. So people, you know, haven't gotten eligibility notices in the mail. They don't know what category they fall into. If you are, you know, a lay person, a Medicaid recipient, all you know is you're eligible for Medicaid based on your household size and income. You don't understand all the other criteria that goes into it. And so we have what I suspect are tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of parents with dependent children who are in a different category and will be losing benefits.
Thank you.
Thank you. And ladies and gentlemen, once again, that is star and then one if you have a question over the phone. We'll take our next question.
Hi, this is John Cheeves. I'm with the Lexington, Kentucky Herald Leader. I had a Kentucky waiver specific question. The case that's going to have the arguments on Friday in Washington is specifically on our waiver, of course. But there is a second lawsuit on Kentucky's waiver. Governor Bevin obviously is suing the plaintiffs in Ural's lawsuit in U.S. District Court in Frankfort, Kentucky. I guess that case is about a month and a half behind the Washington suit. The judge in Washington is a Democratic appointee. The judge in Frankfort is a Republican appointee. And I'm not a lawyer, but I wondered if this doesn't set up the possibility of conflicting opinions, where you could have one U.S. district judge saying that the waiver was legally approved and another district judge saying, no, it was not legally approved. And if that happens, where are we going to be? You know, this summer as the Kentucky program is supposed to come online.
Hi, this is Frederick. Excellent question. I think you're seeing it very clearly. That is absolutely a possibility. If, you know, that were to happen, it would work its way through the appeals process and eventually it would have to be decided by the Supreme Court.
Do we think, can you all still hear me? Am I still on?
Yes.
Yep.
Okay. One way or the other, it does seem likely that this would go up through the appeals process, don't we? We think even the Washington case, which I know is in a different circuit, Washington has its own circuit, doesn't it, the Circuit Court of Appeals of Washington?
Correct.
So we think
way
or the other, whatever the district judge decides, the aggrieved party is going to take it up to the appeals there. Is this bound for the Supreme Court either way?
It's hard to tell because there's a lot of steps and, you know, as the administration's position moves or as new administrations come in, that can impact the trajectory of the lawsuit. So I would say, you know, there's a lot of moving pieces that have to occur before it would actually end up in the Supreme Court.
Okay. Okay. Thank you.
You bet.
And as a reminder, that is star one if you'd like to ask a question. We'll move on to our next question.
Hi, this is for Modern Healthcare. So I was curious that if this lawsuit were successful, would it require further legal action against other approved waivers, or would it create a domino effect if this was found not to be legal? It would, in theory, void all the other ones. And then also, has the Trump administration preemptively stopped them or raised questions about the legality of work requirements in non-expansion states? Because in their, I think, formal response to this lawsuit, they said, I think there's one, it explicitly says that we envision this work requirements for expansion results. So yeah, there are other, like as you were mentioned on this call, Wisconsin, Utah, Kansas, have pending waivers, so because they've already sort of said this, what in our mind we think why we can legally do this, and it can only work in expansion populations, have they preemptively shot themselves in the foot in terms of moving this to non-expansion states?
So this is Elliot, and as to the first part of your question, the primary answer is that it depends on specifically what the ruling is in this case. And there are a range of possible rulings that could stop the Kentucky waiver, but on different potential grounds. But it should be noted that the reason this case is being heard in Washington, D.C. is that it is challenging the authority of the federal government to approve the waiver. So that builds in an element of general applicability inherently into any ruling in this case. So while there is a range of potential outcomes, there's certainly a potential for application in other states that we and others will be keeping a really close eye on. As to non-expansion states, CMS has not stated anything in terms of the legal status of imposing work or other related restrictions on adults in non-expansion states. To this point, it's been a not final policy determination that has come from CMS. And while that decision is certainly welcome for what it is, I would not want to rely on it as a firm and final decision. It's still something that we're involved with advocacy on, and at the state level, we are working closely with the advocacy groups on that issue and not assuming that CMS has definitively ruled out these kinds of requirements in non-expansion states.
Thank you.
And again, ladies and gentlemen, that's star one if you'd like to ask a question over the phone. We'll take our next question.
Hi, it's Todd Spender with the Detroit Free Press again. I just had one follow-up question. It seems from going through some of this material that I'm finding online that only Maine and Wisconsin have asked for waivers that would specifically impose requirements on non-expansion populations. Am I correct about that, or have any other states asked for waivers that would specifically hit non-expansion populations? Thank you.
Hi, this is Frederick. That's not exactly it. We also know that Kansas and Mississippi and Utah have all also are attempting to apply work requirements to non-expansion adults.
Excellent. Thank you.
And, you know, Todd, and this is true for everybody on the call, we have a table that is comprehensive, not just for that question, but, Todd, for your first question about where states are at in the process, that is part of the Waiver Resource Center that's on our website. You can get to it right off the Families USA front page. It's pretty prominently displayed there, and it will show you exactly which states are at which point in the process and which specific elements of their waiver are under consideration. It's really designed for exactly a reporter audience, so hopefully you take a look at that and find it useful.
Much appreciated. Thank you.
Sure.
And Todd, Ms. Fredkin, it's just important to point out, I think in terms of this big picture here, this really is a classic example where there's sort of a conservative narrative about work and the American work ethic being taken, sort of being distorted and being applied to very vulnerable populations. And so, for example, we know that almost half of all Medicaid enrollees who are adults are working. We know that almost 75% are in families with people who are working. So it's a really tough one, because if you look at the polling, if you think the public, if you ask people in general, should people be working, you're almost always going to get an answer of yes. But the underlying reality beneath this is that we're talking about families who are very low income, who might be making $5,000 a year, who have a lot of seasonal work, and are, they're every day, they're trying to find jobs and work, and what we're saying to them is your health is going to be held hostage, as opposed to we want to make sure you have the healthiest life possible so that you can be as self-actualized and accomplish whatever it is you want in life. It's a real kind of Orwellian, tail wagging the dog sort of situation.
Thank you.
And we have no further questions in the queue at this time.
Okay. Well, I think this concludes our call for today. Thank you all for participating, and a recording of this call will be made available soon on our website.
Once again, ladies and gentlemen, that does conclude today's conference. We appreciate your participation today.